Good evening, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Now, this show was here for a couple of weeks, then gone for all of June. I was home, enjoying being a dad for the first time. But now we're back every Friday evening at this time for the foreseeable future. Our mission here is basically to surf the contours of each week's news and sink our teeth into a few choice items that catch our attention. And mixing metaphors like that will get you bonus points. Or is that the closing bell on Wall Street? It's been another bad week, and it's bringing me down. I don't know about you. We'll talk about that. Oil was at new record highs today, and some Americans are cheering, quietly. We'll hear from them. On a similar note, we'll also make fun of Toby Keith. Don't want to miss that. And we'll check in with the first certified Twitter addict in Congress. It's not who you might expect. And if you don't know what Twitter means, I imagine you're like most of his colleagues in the House of Representatives. So I have been away for a few weeks on paternity leave, and while I was gone, the economy seemed to go from ailing to seriously messed up, and we've been seeing a number of headlines this week that are really driving that home. For a large chunk of Americans, and I'd put myself in this group, it looks like we're headed somewhere that we've never been before, those of us who are under 40, I'd say. Here to wrap things up for the week and maybe give folks like me some badly needed perspective, we've got our economist friend, Ed Lauterman. Ed, welcome back to In the Loop.
Great to be here.
So let's talk quickly about the bad vibes this week. First, the chairman of the Federal Reserve was before Congress. He made some other speeches, basically saying we're going to be in this stew for a long time yet.
Yes, they extended this special lending facility for lending large sums of money to investment banks, other financial institutions that didn't access the Fed in the past.
This is the way Bear Stearns maybe was bailed out
exactly.
A couple months ago.
There's sort of two sides to that. One is, it's sort of encouraging to financial markets that this help isn't going away. But the other side of it is we're continuing it because we think it's really necessary.
This week, people are also really declaring that we are in a bear market. And obviously that means the stock market is down, but I'm just kind of curious, what's the tipping point where everybody begins saying, yep, it's a bear market?
You know, it's one of those things where there's no strict rule, but I think typically they say if it's down 20% from a peak, then it's a bear market. The economy is getting softer. All these problems in the financial sector are spilling over. We do have extremely high-priced oil. They're talking this week about how natural gas for heating here in Minnesota is going to be up 40 to 60% over last year. Northwest Airlines announced it's going to lay off 2,500 people. You keep getting these negative reports about the economy, and none of them are in themselves, you know, catastrophic. But it certainly creates a sense that things are getting worse.
And people are saying now, you know, recession looks highly likely. We're probably in it already. Bear market for sure. Those of us who are really under 40 have never really been through this kind of thing. If we were alive in the 1970s, we weren't really paying much attention. We were barely born or in our teens, or not born yet. So as someone who's been there before, if you're willing to play that role, how scared, you know, how intimidated should we be about where we're going here?
I mean, it sort of depends on how close it gets to home. We get used to little consumer things that are nice, we enjoy, that become part of our daily life, but they're not really a necessity. Fancy coffees, for example, you know. But when you're scared about losing your job, then you decide that, you know, you really could just get a cup of coffee somewhere. The one kicker we have right now that we didn't have in those previous recessions is we have many more people who are losing their houses and who are in danger of losing their house. You certainly had that happen in prior recessions, but it was not something the average Joe worried about.
Is there a possibility that we may be heading somewhere here that even you and your generation have not been?
If there's anything that the last 18 months have shown, it's that economists are absolutely lousy, worthless at making predictions. But I think just sort of on a subjective level, I think that we're probably headed toward a recession in the range of what we had 1979 to 1982. And that would be significantly worse than the mini one we sort of had in 2000 or 2001.
I'm going to ask you to maybe tap into a little bit of your sadism here, but is there any part of you that, you know, is glad to see our generation maybe learning what this is like, experiencing some harder times?
Not glad to see, but I guess sort of a sense of, you know, it had to happen sooner or later. Happy days can't go on forever. I'm not taking any joy in that, you know. they're finally getting what they need to know.
No, of course not. But are there some important lessons that we can expect to learn from this?
People's perceptions of reality get distorted when you have a bubble like the housing bubble we went through. You know, when your house is going up 10 or 12% a year and you can refinance and get a little lower interest rate and take some cash out to pay off your credit cards, you know, we can always buy something we want. There's a misperception of sort of the long-term realities of life. And I think we're going to learn that. We got to be a little more careful, a little more conservative in our spending. There are more sharks in the sea than your generation was aware of, I guess would be one way of putting it.
Yeah, we all need to grow up economically sooner or later.
Yeah.
I suppose. Well, Ed, thanks very much for coming in.
Good to be here.
Ed Lauterman, economics teacher and writer. His column, Real World Economics, appears in the St. Paul Pioneer Press. You are listening to The Week from In the Loop, and I am Jeff Horwich. Little rundown of political notes from the past week, kind of a snarky edition today. Is there anywhere too big for a speech by Barack Obama? I don't think so. His campaign has decided that instead of accepting the nomination in Denver's Pepsi Center with the rest of the convention, they'll move it to Mile High Invesco Stadium before 75,000 screaming fans like he's Coldplay on tour or something. No one has pulled that move since John F. Kennedy. And Germans are divided about whether to honor Obama's request to speak at the Brandenburg Gate, the symbolic boundary between East and West Berlin. Only elected U.S. presidents have ever spoken there. It was another big Kennedy photo op. It's also where Reagan gave his Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall speech. I actually think Obama can go further, make a stop in the Middle East, and plan a speech from the slopes of Mount Sinai. That'll show him who's big. If Jesse Jackson doesn't cut him down to size first. Jackson didn't know his mic was open when he leaned over to another TV guest on Fox and whispered how he'd like to sever certain parts of Obama's male anatomy. Jackson was mad over comments Obama made about African-American men taking responsibility for their actions. Our politicians make these things way, way too easy. John McCain is making a play for dejected Hillary Clinton supporters. He was near us in the Twin Cities today, as a matter of fact, holding a women-only forum on economics. But here's a non-economic topic to introduce into the mix. Ask him how he ended it with his first wife. It's kind of an ugly story. Something tells me John McCain will have plenty of challenges with women voters when the campaign turns nasty in the fall. And the G8 summit in Japan will probably best be remembered for an unofficial pronouncement. President Bush was wrapping up his final private meeting with the other world leaders, and here's how he signed off. He did a fist pump and said, "Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter." That's according to senior British sources who were at the meeting. The joke reportedly did not go over very well, but it's nice to know he still has a sense of humor at times like these. And the price of oil this week was up at the beginning and then down pretty substantially, and many people were feeling a pretty good sense of relief there for a day or two until Iran fired off a bunch of missiles and the price of oil was up again, and it looks like it's going to be there for a while. A lot of people are trying to come to terms with $4 gasoline. Not everybody is upset about it, and we asked our producer Sandon Totten to think a little bit about that. Sandon is here with me now. Hey.
Hey, Jeff. How's it going?
Well, I'm doing well, but of course I'm gritting my teeth, it seems like, over high gas prices like everybody else. Who has something of a silver lining out of this situation?
Well, there's definitely an upside to it. You just kind of got to dig into it a little bit. You know, for instance, gas prices are up, more people are staying off the road. You get some good things like, you know, fewer traffic deaths, less pollution. And if you drive less, you actually get cheaper insurance. So, you know, that's a boost. And, you know, a lot of people have been hopping on their bikes, and that's been making more people lose weight. And in fact, an economist at the University of North Carolina who studies this says that a permanent $1 hike in gas prices could cut obesity in America by 10%.
Okay, that makes sense. So we all can get healthier, provided we actually change our habits during all this.
Right, right. But when it comes down to it, I think most Americans deal with gas prices like a smoker deals with quitting cigarettes. You know, they know they should do it. They know it'd be good for them. But they just can't do it. But what if kicking the gas habit really was like a life or death kind of thing?
Got somebody like that?
Yeah. Well, Katie Uchel, she's 26 years old, and she lives in St. Paul. She was actually diagnosed with blood clots in her lungs a year ago. The doctors gave her a 50% chance of survival.
At 26?
At 26, wow. Yeah. And so this whole big mess of health problems got her thinking about a serious overhaul in her lifestyle, I'll let her explain.
I was trying to think of ways that I could increase my lung capacity and get healthier. And around the time that I was starting to think of ways to do this, gas prices really shot through the roof. And so I was like, okay, kind of makes sense for me to try and replace some of my trips that I've been doing by driving by bicycling. And maybe this will have a side benefit of helping me breathe better. Now I am still doing the same thing, but to boot, I can actually breathe much more easily. I don't wheeze and cough with every single breath. And on top of that, I've lost 10 pounds in the past few months, which is added bonus.
Katie says that even if gas prices dropped, she's going to stick with her two-wheeler.
Well, I can see how this might even create habits that would be good, not just for your health, but for relationships. When gas prices started going up, my wife and I started carpooling almost every day, which is something that we very rarely did before.
Oh, quality time. Yeah, that's definitely an upside. Higher gas prices, though, can also be a source of tension for some couples. Take Dan Ninus, for example. He's a banker by day, but in his dreams, he's something a little more rebellious.
I've always wanted a motorcycle. When the gas was getting so high, I thought, well, hey, I only drive 2 miles to work. It doesn't make sense to be starting up my car all the time. Perfect opportunity for me to get a motorcycle.
He goes on about that all the time.
That's Jonna Ninus, Dan's wife. And he's been trying to convince her for years now to let him get a motorcycle. He thinks that high gas prices might be his winning gambit. But so far, she's not convinced.
Taking a motorcycle versus taking the car would save gas. However, we're talking about buying the bike, insuring the bike.
Probably taking out an additional life insurance policy.
And the fact that we live in Minnesota and you're going to be able to drive it.
And what happens when I get called at work to pick you up because it's raining?
There's hail outside. You can't take your bike
in case you get creamed by some driver who's just not paying attention. What happens then?
So like I said, I have a lot of more convincing to do. In this area, I'm figuring $5 a gallon, that probably would...
Try 11.
11?
Okay. 11.
So at least there's one guy in Fridley, Minnesota, who's just rooting for gas prices to go through the roof.
All right, Sandon Totten, some unconventional thinking on rising gas prices. Thanks for doing that.
No problem, Jeff.
This is The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Many of us can make adjustments to deal with rising gas prices. It's not so easy to change course if you're a giant American auto company. All the proof you need is in the television commercials right now, at least here in Minnesota. Chrysler, for example, will guarantee you $3 gas for the next 2 years, as insulation against the fact that most of their cars, not such good mileage. And Ford. Every time I turn around, they're trying to convince me I need an F-150. It's a Ford mainstay, but sales are, well, they're in the tank. And maybe it's just me. I think the sales pitch is clearly getting a little desperate.
Howdy do, America. I'm country music superstar Toby Keith. Now, I know times are tough for hardworking Americans, but I'm here on a very important mission. I'm here to convince you, you need to buy a giant truck.
You need a giant truck. Yeah, you need a big fat truck.
Come on, forget about the stale economy and the highest gas prices in history. The Ford F-150 is the truck that helped build this country. It's as American as strip malls, disposable diapers, and coal. And this month, we're offering you employee pricing. That's right, you pay what they pay. Because right now, even our own employees don't want to buy these things.
We made way too many of these here trucks. Come on, you need a big fat truck.
Because when gas hits $10 a gallon and your town turns into Thunderdome, do you want to be driving around in a Prius? How many cans of precious gasoline can you hoard in the back of a Honda Fit? When all hell breaks loose, you'll be thanking God for best-in-class payload capacity, bone-crushing four-wheel drive, and a reinforced quad cab built Ford Tough to keep your family safe from the mob.
Don't want to get beat up? Help us out and buy a big fat truck.
A Ford F-150, now at employee pricing. Because fuel economy is for terrorist pansies.
Please buy a big old truck. If we don't sell these things, we're totally screwed. It's not our fault we've had such rotten luck. Come on, you need a big fat truck.
Come on in and help a company out.
I don't know, you be the judge. Is it too much? Are they coming on too strong? Toby Keith had a birthday this past week, as a matter of fact. Turned 47, I think. And I remember him, boy, back when he was just doing long-distance commercials for 1010 220 with Alf. Changing gears now. Get it? This week, we got a very modern debate in Congress about how its members communicate with the outside world. Very much at the center of it is a congressman with a particular compulsion for sharing the nitty-gritty of congressional life with the rest of us. That's John Culberson. He's a four-term Republican from Texas's 7th District near Houston. And he is with us now to talk about what the big deal is. Congressman, thanks for joining us on In the Loop.
Jeff, it's good to be with you and your listeners in Minnesota.
Now, we need to give people a few details here. You are way into Twitter. Now, that's not quite a household word yet, and various devices are making noise in the background there.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. You've got a lot strapped to your belt, I know.
Yeah.
tell us about Twitter, and we'll test your Twitter acumen here in as brief a fashion as you can. What exactly are you up to?
Well, in fact, Jeff, I'm using what's called social media, all of the high technology tools on the internet that are available to me. I'm using the Twitter.com website, which is a mini blog. It allows me to post very short notices of what I'm doing, 140 characters or less, to people that are following me. I'm also using a website called Quik, Quik.com, to broadcast live streaming video. I have been sending updates to my constituents, people that are following me on my Twitter website. I, for example, update them on what we're debating or voting on the House floor.
And people can choose, you know, anybody can choose to follow your feed and see all of these things that you're posting.
Yes.
You know, some
are
very much related to House business. Some are just sort of personal. As you were rushing to get to this interview and we wondered where you were, I was checking and you had Twittered, which we appreciated because it let me know that you were on the way, presumably, or at least concerned about being on
the
way.
That might have been an accident. And of course, the button might have been pushed on the BlackBerry, but nevertheless.
I prefer to think you had us in mind. But in any case, now, on Tuesday this week, you Twittered this. I just learned the Dems are trying to censor congressmen's ability to use Twitter, Quik, YouTube, etc. Outrageous, and I will fight them. What's going on?
Absolutely. I just learned yesterday of this proposed House rule that is indeed, it is aimed at restricting the ability of members of Congress to post videos on the internet. Now, the rule will eventually reach blogs, Twitter, text postings, any other kind of posting as well. But the initial thrust of the rule is to restrict our ability to post video on any outside website that is not approved, certified, and sanitized by House administration. And I just think it's a bad idea. It's an infringement of my free speech rights as a member of Congress and an infringement of the rights of the people out there who are using the internet to look and listen to every corner, nook, and cranny of Congress. And that's a good thing, and we shouldn't restrict it.
Okay, well, here's the reason they give, and it makes a certain amount of sense. This is Congressman Michael Capuano, a Democrat from Massachusetts, who mm-hmm. is proposing this rule change. And what he says is that communications from Congress should happen in places that reflect favorably on the dignity, propriety, and decorum of the House.
Well, that is certainly true, but that should be left to each one of us using our own independent good judgment. And if a member of Congress violates those common sense boundaries that are out there and the legal ones that quite obviously prevent us, for example, from using official resources to promote ourselves in an election campaign. If we're posting a video on a site that's inappropriate, the House administration should then come down hard on those members individually that have exercised poor judgment.
You're going back and forth on Twitter with people with screen names like Techno Sailor and Cheeky Geeky, and those are a couple I clicked through to sort of see where they were, and they're not in your district.
Mm-hmm.
How do you rationalize spending so much time, and as I understand from your staff, you do spend a lot of time doing this, communicating with people who are not actually your constituents?
Well, actually, there's a large number of people that are my followers that are from Houston, that are from the district. My job description is representative, and I take that very seriously. And to be a good representative, I need to use as many tools as I can to communicate effectively with not only my district, but people that are interested in what I'm doing. Obviously, my primary focus is the people of my district in West Houston, District 7. But to communicate effectively in the 21st century requires using these new tools in ways that have not been used before. It's an exciting experiment in real-time democracy, and try to open up and shine sunlight into as many dark corners of Congress as I can.
I'm going to cite another one of your Twitter posts from not too long ago. Twitter is addictive. Is there a term for not being able to walk away from Twitter? I need to sleep. See you all tomorrow. Are you a Twitter addict, Congressman?
Well, I'll tell you, it's fun when you get into an interesting debate with someone who is thoughtful. That's always a debate I enjoy. So as you can notice, some of those are late at night. So I'm probably depriving myself of some sleep that I need. But that's the one time a day that I can do it and not take time away from my family. But in order for this to succeed, it's going to require some effort.
Well, one would have to worry if you're always, you know, typing away on your little thingy, your BlackBerry, or filming things on your cell phone. You know, is there enough mental space left for stuff like you're reading bills, writing bills, committee hearings?
Oh, absolutely.
You
know,
are you distracted by all this technology?
No, I've always been good at multitasking. This is a wonderful way to communicate with people. And I think as time goes by, Jeff, you're going to continue to see people bring technology into their daily routine in ways we really can't even imagine yet. And I think it will be as natural in the years to come for members of Congress to use live streaming video to communicate with their constituents, to use services like Twitter or other social media networks. Those will all become a part of the daily routine of a member of Congress. And I'll be proud to have been one of the first pioneers to help make that happen.
Well, as long as you continue to stay up all night tweeting about it, it'll be very easy for the rest of us to keep following how this all plays out. Congressman John Culberson from Texas's 7th District, thank you very much, and I'll let you get back
Enjoyed
to your
it.
Routine.
We're going back to vote right now.
All right, have fun.
Very good. Thank you, Jeff.
Now, there's an update on this story before we call it a day here. There's been quite a fracas building on the Hill and in techie corners of the internet over the Twitter Dome scandal, as some are now calling it. So House Speaker Nancy Pelosi put out a statement this afternoon. She says Democrats are not trying to quash free speech. The point here is to modernize old-fashioned rules that don't account for modern technology and come up with standards that actually make it easier for members to publish on external sites. Here's a little more. Quote, I can assure you that it is not the intention, nor will it be the result of the final regulations, to stifle, censor, or deprive members of communicating effectively and in real time with their constituents. One announcement before we go. In the Loop has our latest Story Slam coming up July 23rd at the Bedlam Theater in Minneapolis, where we've been for the last couple of slams. Our timely topic this time, tightening the belt. For more info about the Story Slam or anything In the Loop related, visit minnesotapublicradio.org/InTheLoop. We're blogging every day. There's a podcast. It's great fun, I can assure you. The Week is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We are edited by Kate Smith. Our theme and much of our other music is by The Smarts. Hope you had a good week. I'm Jeff Horwich.